You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, May 30th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Gar Alperowitz, historian, political economist, activist, writer, author of What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. Also on the program today, President Obama nominates a Republican who was part of the Bush administration as head of the FBI, a guy with a mixed bag of experience in the Bush administration, a dramatic, literally near deathbed save of John Ashcroft, but also a guy who ended up going along with some of the worst excesses of the Bush administration. Also, the decline of unions tied, perhaps unsurprisingly, but now scientifically, to the decline in labor's share of the economy and income over the past 30 years. We'll get to that Thomas Friedman story where he discovers things called job placement agencies. Another fast food strike, this time in Seattle. And interesting report about immigrants' impact on Medicare, all that, more. I got some feedback yesterday from a phone call we got from an IMer in the better half of the program yesterday. This is a guy who is a libertarian and apparently, as far as I can tell, a Alex Jones fan.
I actually think he was mocking Alex Jones.
I don't know if he was mocking Alex Jones or not, but he was a libertarian who would punctuate some of his arguments on IM to me with things like Jew. Now, it makes sense in the context of, do we have a problem with fundamentalist Jews and fundamentalist Muslims and fundamentalist Christians? But in this case, it was just, I think, something about raising the minimum wage, and then it was just comma Jew. And so some people took issue with the fact that I wasn't harsher with him when he called in. But I appreciate that he called in, and I want to reiterate that if you're a libertarian and you have an argument to make about particularly libertarian economics, which I think is akin to childish fantasy, and really, in some respects, underdeveloped childish fantasies, because I like to think that, you know, some children out there actually can attain some type of emotional maturity and intellectual maturity. I have debated libertarians who were not total morons. But they, I have to say, they've been far and few between. And I don't know if that's a function of the type of people who want to call into a show or not. But I want to make it clear that if you're a libertarian, you can call this show, 646-257-3920, any day, Monday through Friday, after about, we start taking calls around 1:15 or so, p.m. Eastern. And in particular, if you want to even have a bigger platform, I'm going to be filling in for Tom Hartman on Monday, 3 to 6 p.m. East Coast time. You can get his number. You can find his number at tomhartman.com. And you can call into that program when I'm taking calls and make a case about libertarianism. I'd like to hear it. Because and I'm talking about economic libertarianism. There's some areas where I agree with some libertarian principles, but I don't even think they necessarily have to be libertarian principles by the very fact that I'm not a libertarian and I agree with them. But call in, make your case. Keep the insults to a minimum if you can. All right, and the reason why I also raise that is for this story that came out in this month's Science magazine. German researchers have found in an experimental setup, or an experiment, I should say, that at least indicates that markets, participation in markets make us less moral. Now, why is this important? Because the libertarians would have you believe that the marketplace will self-regulate, that the marketplace, that people will pay a price if they're immoral or they take advantage of other people or they sell bad products. Now, this, of course, presumes some type of symmetry of information, which we know does not exist. If I take my water to a private testing company that is not in any way regulated by the EPA or following EPA standards, and the guy says to me, I tried your water out, it's perfect. It may be 30 years down the road before I find out that I've gotten cancer because of the crap that was in this water. And I may not even be able to attribute it to my water. There's plenty of examples, but that's the first one that comes to mind. So in this experiment, German researchers took a first group, three groups. The first group was presented with two options. Receive $13 for accepting the death of a lab mouse, or forgo the money and save the mouse's life. 46% said they would accept the mouse's death in exchange for that $13. 46%. So, you know, some people have no problem with the death of a mouse for a couple bucks. I'm not judging. That's not the point of this study. There was a second group of people who participated in a bilateral market scenario. Just two people. One buyer, one seller interacted directly with each other. The seller was given a mouse and told, the life of the mouse is entrusted into your care. But you could sell it to the buyer for a price as far up as, you know, about $15. And the buyer got to keep the difference between the 13 and the 15. Or I'm sorry, $26. And so the buyer got to keep the difference between $26 and $13. If they decided not to make a deal, neither person got any money, and the mouse was allowed to live. In that group, 72% of sellers were willing to kill the mouse for the money. For the same $13, assuming they could get the highest price possible, you had 32% more people, or 30% more people, more or less, willing to kill the mouse. They had a third group, which was a multilateral market. 7 buyers, 9 sellers that could trade amongst themselves. And 76% again decided they'd kill the mouse for $13. In a marketplace, it was found, people on average valued the mouse's life less than they did when individually asked. This is evidence, say the researchers, that market interaction lowers moral values as compared to individual actions. If you perceive killing the mouse as to be somewhat immoral for you to just get a couple of bucks. The experiments were run again, and this time, instead of killing the mouse, it was just coupons. You would lose a coupon instead of the mouse being killed. And the coupons were basically valueless. With a non-living subject, market sellers gave up the coupons about as often as participants acting individually. You follow that? With a non-living subject, market sellers gave up the coupons about as often as participants acting individually. In other words, there was no difference between when it was just someone asked directly to give up your coupon for $13. Someone in a market with 2 people, give up your coupon for $13. There was no 76 to 46% disparity, which shows that when an individual is faced with this question of giving up the mouse for $13, they are less comfortable doing so. They feel some more moral compulsion to basically give up the cash and allow the mouse to live. Scientists have a couple of questions as to, they have a couple of ideas. They have no proof as to why this is the case. But they suspect that when you're interacting in a market, whether it's with one other person or multiple people, you disperse responsibility. It's not just me killing that mouse. This guy's willingly participating in it too. So it can't be that bad. It's what we know about corporations. They're explicitly less liable, individuals involved in a corporation. They're explicitly less liable, and they certainly have the tendency to do worse things because they're looking across the table and their coworkers doing it too. Yeah, so we put out that Ford Pinto with the exploding rear. Everybody around here seems to have no problem with it. I'm not going to have a problem with it either. So it's just an interesting implication of market forces and why we need regulation on markets.
Did the mice know about the voucher system or the payments?
There you have it. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Gar Alperovitz. I pre-taped this interview the other day. Still, just as fresh as it was then. And we'll be right back. And we'll be right back. We are back on the Majority Report. Joining me now is Gar Alperovitz. He is a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland. He is also the author of What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. And there is a film available now by the same title. Gar, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Look forward to it.
Now, so let's... in your book, you talk about that we are now facing a systemic versus a political crisis. And so let's start from there. Delineate that for us.
Well, the difference is when you see long trends that simply don't get changed by politics as we know it. Then you know you've got something buried deeper in the bowels of the system that's driving this. So, for instance, over 30 years, the top 1% has moved from having about 10% of the income up to about 20-21% of the income over time. Republicans, Democrats, different presidents, the trend continues, and you know it's coming from something deeper. Climate change issues. 30% increase in CO2 output over since 1970, and it doesn't much matter who's in office. You can find different places in if you ask people over time. 30, 40 years ago, you do a poll and ask them, do they believe their government represents them? And more or less, you get 70% saying, absolutely, the folks we send to Washington represent my views. 30 years later, the trend is steadily down, and they say people in Washington... But the same percentage, only the other side, two-thirds will say, or 70% will say, no, they represent the corporations and special interests. So virtually, and the book goes through this, in What Then Must We Do, the different trends that demonstrate not only that they can't alter the trends, but now you can't get through things in Congress, there's stagnation in the economy, and the system itself is locked in and not able to respond in the way that it used to.
Are we in an unprecedented time in this country, or have we seen have we been at this point before?
I think this is something really new. It is similar in some ways to the Great Depression, but the collapse of the Great Depression and the chance that there was a Republican in office who took the heat. Imagine what would have happened had there been a Democrat. And then the Republicans are very conservative. In Europe, it went, you know, fascists took over because they could blame it on somebody else. But Democrats took over and were able to solve some of the problems, and World War II really solved the economic problem. So that's the closest analogy. But I think we're in an era where reform no longer can alter the painful trends. They just get slowly worse. Stagnation with an occasional uptick and an occasional downtick. Decay is the experience, and insecurity, that's another part of the experience. And the whole reform movement, and I've come out of that movement, is itself in decline, the traditional movement. I'm optimistic about the slow buildup of a very non-traditional movement, but labor unions were the core of the traditional liberal alliance, and all over the world, for that matter, social democracy in Europe. And they've gone from 34.5% of the labor force were members at the peak in 1953. They're down to the 11% range now. And in the private sector, 6.6% of the labor force is unionized. So it's a very declining organizational power, sadly. But it's also declining in political muscle to use to balance the corporations. And I think that's really what's happening in the system, as opposed to, who gets elected tomorrow. The underlying system, there's no countervailing force institutionally to balance the power of the corporations. And I think that's really the dynamics underneath the systemic crisis. The old way of balancing corporate capitalism is simply declining and decaying before your eyes.
Let's talk about that. I mean, maybe we're circling around here a little bit, but I want to just briefly dive into that, because I think, I've heard you describe yourself that in the past you had self-identified as a progressive liberal. You worked in the House and in the Senate on the staff, as well as in the State Department.
I mean, I imagine that that the way that you have evolved in your perspective was a function of a coming realization that the function of liberalism and progressivism no longer worked because of the change in the context, because of this systemic problem.
Yes, that's true. I've directed staffs in both the House and Senate, and I was at a high level doing policy planning for United Nations matter in the State Department. I left all that during the Vietnam War. But the hope of old, the progressive tradition, and many people still hold on to this, and I understand that and I respect them, is that you could balance, John Kenneth Galbraith called it countervailing force, to balance the corporate system. And the heart of that was not only political movements, which is very important, and I strongly support a movement-building effort, but also institutional power, real muscle organizationally, and that was the labor union movement. And all over the world, by the way, in Western Europe and in England and also in the United States, that's the way the corporation system was balanced politically. Well, that's declined, and I personally began realizing the trends weren't going to change. And secondly, that the primary source was the decline in the institutional arrangements and the architecture of the system. So either, and this is what the book, What Then Must We Do, is about, either there is a new institutional power base built along with a movement, or the trends continue. And I think that's the dilemma we're facing. I mean, the good news is that out of the pain that people are feeling, and out of the almost desperation and dead ends at the local level, and you know, we go into some communities like Detroit or Cleveland, Ohio, and you see decay, and you give a big tax break to the corporations that come in. They come in, take the tax break, and then they're gone in 10 years. Or you try to do a worker training program, there's no jobs for them to be trained to. You do an anti-poverty program, the money gets taken away. So either there's a new alternative coming out of that desperation, that pain, or the pain continues. What we are seeing, and this is really the subject of the of What Then Must We Do, we're seeing a whole development of really democratized ownership structures, new institutions. An obvious example is worker-owned companies. That isn't about trying to counterbalance the corporation. That's about building a different structure in which the workers own the companies. Now, most people don't realize that there are the 10,000 of worker-owned companies in the United States of one kind or another. 3 million more people are involved already than are members of unions in the private sector. Some of these are good, some of them are bad, some are democratic. There's a whole array of them and much chance for development within that. And then there's a whole new movement of people trying to build worker co-ops. So building institutions, the primary characteristic of which is somehow changing ownership patterns. You could counterpose that to the existing patterns. You know, 400, this is a shocking number that I checked many times, but it really tells you something about where power lies. If power goes along with wealth, and it usually does in any system, the top 400 people in the United States, 400 individuals, you could get them in a large auditorium, small auditorium, or a schoolroom. 400 individuals have more wealth than the bottom 180 million people taken together. It's a medieval concentration of power. Although I said that in a lecture recently, and a medieval historian corrected me. He said, no, it was never that concentrated, even in medieval times. So either we build up, and this is part of the argument of What Then Must We Do, either we build up alternative ways to own wealth, or that power continues. And the traditional way was the socialist state, and that had its own problems. But what we're seeing is very American. Worker-owned co-ops are developing. There are 130 million Americans who are already members of co-ops and co-op credit unions. Credit unions, you know, are a one-person, one-vote bank. And there are, 70, 80 million people involved in that, and some of them are becoming more activist than they have been in the past. There are things going on in many, many states in which land at the center of the city is becoming publicly or community-owned instead of giving it to the developers. The book reports on things that the press simply is not covering, partly because they're not interested, partly because many local newspapers are owned by very conservative people, but also, above all, because the press has lost its financial base. And, you know, newspapers have been in terrible financial state, and they've been cutting reporters, and the first one they cut is somebody who's reporting on local events. So people don't realize that there is an undercurrent building up that suggests a very, very different direction locally, that democratic direction. And there are also some things at the state and national level which we could get into if we have time.
Yeah, I would like to get into that. But I want to go back again just a little bit, if I could, because to really tease out the difference between what we're seeing in terms of institutional power and political power, because we had at one point no institutional base from which to reform the excesses of capitalism, and then we did. Can you just tell us how that growth happens, and then reflect it back upon what you see as the nascent growth of institutions, which seem to be more localized than the last time we dealt with this?
Well, there are two different forms of it that are really interesting. One is, you know, labor unions in 1929 were about 11% of the membership of labor unions represented about 11% of the labor force, very small. The Depression and World War II, two quite unusual events, massive world war and a massive world depression, created conditions in which labor moved radically up to 34.5% by just after the war, largely driven by organizing, but also the context was very special. The war made it easy for organizing, and so did the Depression. After that, it's been downhill back to a level that it was before. So that's one of the bases of liberalism, went up and now has been decaying. There's a whole other set of institutions, and this is partly one way to think about what's going on nationally now. You know, the things that became national elements of the New Deal, think of labor law, think of protection for workers in the workplace, the capacity to unionize, Social Security, things that became very common national programs, were developed quietly in the states and localities in the decades before the New Deal. And I think that's the way to think about what's going on around the country now, the slow buildup of things that when the moment arises, there's enough momentum, and then it goes national. Or think of the women's movement in the 19th century, you know, decade after decade, slowly moving state by state, and finally nationally. And what's happened now, we've got 12 states slowly, slowly building up the right of people to marry anyone they want to marry, and that builds up over time. And I think we'll ultimately go nationally. That's the way this changing who gets to own wealth at the local level is developing, and in my view, could be the basis, along with things at the state and national level that we can talk about, as I mentioned, could be the basis of a much larger institutional buildup to repower a very different, transformative, progressive era.
And there was a piece that I read of yours a couple of months back where you took the data from what has been the two most looked up words in 2012 from Merriam-Webster's dictionary. The two most looked up words in 2012 were socialism and capitalism. And this is an indication, I mean, because I'm interested in this notion, and I'd like to discuss, you know, to walk us through almost sort of a remedial tour, if you will, of what socialism is, in fact, and its various forms as we talk about this. But it's indicative that there is at least a broader dissatisfaction, particularly amongst the youth, in what is going on. It's almost you take that as an indication that there is a growing awareness that our problem is systemic as opposed to political. And just walk us through the notion and the central idea that is undergird socialism?
Well, you know, the socialist idea is actually in line with the ideas of many analysts of how systems work, and also with common sense. Who gets to own the property, who's got the money, is usually the most powerful place to look for who controls the action. And, you know, in feudalism, the lords and the king and the church owned the land, and they controlled the power. In corporate capitalism, the corporations and the tiny elites own the bulk of the wealth, and they control or dominate the action, unless they're offset by labor unions, and that's what I was pointing out, declining. The socialist idea, and socialism comes in many, many different forms, but the one people know about, the state should own the wealth, and then but the state will own the power. But there are obvious problems with the traditional socialist idea, because with that power comes the capacity to destroy democracy and liberty. What's interesting, and it's very American in its flavor, building up from the ground up, if you think about co-ops and worker-owned companies and municipal utilities, there are 2,000 publicly owned municipal utilities, socialist institutions, if you like, operating in America today. 25% of our electricity comes from publicly owned socialist institutions and co-ops. Well, the pattern is, yes, you must change who gets to own the wealth, the productive wealth, because that's where the power is. But what's very American about the things that I see building up and write about in this book, What Then Must We Do, is it starts at the lowest level, not at the centralized government. It starts at the neighborhoods. It starts at the workplace. It starts at the local city. And it is a, you know, the Catholic Church has this term subsidiarity. Only go to the highest, the next level up if you have to. Otherwise, keep it local. And that's a very different vision. You know, part I write in the book, if you don't like corporate capitalism and you don't like state socialism, what do you want? You really got to face that. And what's interesting about the nature of these developments that are coming out really out of pain and effort is that they are very decentralized, very American, but they also do begin to change the pattern of who gets to own the wealth. And as I say, for instance, the State Bank of North Dakota takes it up one step. Most people don't realize there is a socialized bank in North Dakota, a very conservative state. But there it sits, 90 years operating, very successful. Small business likes it. Labor likes it. The farmers like it. And it makes money for the taxpayer. Well, 20 states have introduced legislation to do what North Dakota has been doing for 90 years, and I think we're going to see more of that kind of thing at the state level. And, you know, we could go on going at the state and even national level. There are many, many things happening that the press just isn't covering that move in this direction.
Well, let's talk about those things that are happening on the state and national level. Aside from the organizing of banks, what else do we see?
Well, here, I think perhaps I'll mention one, and then the most important one we'll come to at the state level. Most people don't realize, again, this is capitalist America, but 27 different states have agencies which own shares in companies that the state helps get going. They actually own the means of production. So these are startup companies that in Maryland are making a lot of money for the taxpayer. And in 27 different states, that's common in America today. But you don't read about it very much. But it's an example of what can happen.
What are the nature of these startups? I mean, they tend to be tech oriented, or what?
Yeah, most are now increasingly tech oriented. They're startups, and some of them, you know, it's venture capital is part of this. And I write about it in the book and give references to many different states that are doing it. But it's very conventional and just not discussed. It goes on all the time. One that is discussed, many people know about, is the state of Alaska, the conservative state of Alaska. As a matter of law, people get proceeds, dividends, from state wealth ownership of oil. And, you know, the best year they had, I think, a couple of years ago, about $2,000 for everybody as a matter of legal right. So, you know, husband and wife and three kids is $10,000. Coming out of ownership of those resources. So that's one level of things that people just don't know, and I try to write about it in What Then Must We Do, that you can do this if you can do this in your state. There are different ways to do it, ownership patterns. and changing who owns. But what probably the most important upcoming area, in addition to state banking, which I think is proceeding, what's happening in healthcare, I think, is people who really look at it, is that the way in which the pain levels are going to increase, the corporations are going to set up what is called, they're now calling it, quote, skinny, unquote, insurance plans. It very slimmed down so that they're very cheap, but they meet the technical requirement of the law, but the workers aren't going to be covered for anything that really matters. And then there's going to be a lot of pain and suffering and bankruptcies and, you know, people thrown off the rolls and hospitals not taking people, and the sort of, you know, agony will come out of that. But also anger and also cost pressures. So I write about the health care, and if I had one thing to suggest, I think we're going to see movement towards single-payer health care at the state level. Now, Vermont is going to set one up, is in the process of setting it up. It'll be up in 2014. California passed it twice, but it was vetoed by Schwarzenegger. But I think the pain levels are going to drive state by state by state to do this. Now, think about that. What a Medicare, what a single-payer health care system is, it's the same as Medicare, which is a publicly owned insurance company as opposed to a private insurance company. That's what single payer is, and that's what Medicare is, a publicly owned insurance company. And if you think about Vermont, that will slowly displace, rather than countervail, it will displace the private insurance companies. I think we're going to see over the next decade many, many states developing this out of the pain levels. And now we're talking about big money, because the healthcare system currently is almost 20%. It's about 18% of the economy, a fifth of the economy. And slowly moving in that direction is very, very interesting. And furthermore, some of the hospitals now, in Cleveland this is underway, the Cleveland Clinic and many other hospitals, using some of their purchasing power in that city and several other cities to support worker-owned companies. So you're getting another feedback loop here in the most creative part. Cleveland is way ahead of the curve because they're doing very sophisticated worker-owned companies, partly supported by purchase from hospitals and universities with, you know, a lot of tax money in those institutions. So that's another large driver at the healthcare sector. Banking and healthcare, I think, are the really hot places to look for states over the next 20 years, because that's where the action's beginning to develop in interesting ways. And there are also some national things, and again, we could get into that if we have time.
Yes, let's do.
Well, you know, if you look, experts on the left, right, and centered, you know, and I follow this fairly closely, most serious banking specialists who study what's going on in the banking area realize that the banking laws that were passed after the last crisis are so full of loopholes that the big banks and the big you know, Wall Street firms can get around them and keep their speculations going. And indeed, they are more concentrated now than they were before the banking crisis. Well, the prediction by most experts is there's going to be another financial crisis, and the question is whether it's next year or 2 years or 5 years, not whether it will happen, but when it will happen. And there's already a lot of anger at the banks, coming not only from the left but from the right. The Tea Party was more angry at the banks than many progressives. And I think down the line that the whole banking sector is so out of line and so irresponsible. You know, the Attorney General of the United States of America testified before Congress that he could not sue the banks because it would create a financial crisis. Unbelievable statement by the chief law enforcement officer of the United States. They can do what they want to do criminally, and he can't sue them because he fears there'll be a financial crisis. Well, at some point, the anger's got to break when the next crisis or the one thereafter happens. And the current nostrum is break them up, which may happen. And anybody who knows anything about the history of AT&T or Standard Oil knows that if you break them up, they'll regroup and be back at the table more concentrated. So I think down the line, over the next decade, two or three, if this keeps up, what you're going to see is, oddly enough, the old conservative economists who were worried about Milton Friedman's teachers at the University of Chicago, they pointed out, and they got a Nobel Prizes for this argument, that the big companies and the big banks will always capture the regulators. You can't regulate them. They will regulate the regulators. They're too strong, and that's what's happening in the banking sector. So then the other argument is, well, if you break them up, that would do the job. And these old conservatives said, break them up, yep, but they will be back concentrated again and regroup, and they'll be back doing what they wanted to do. And these conservatives argued, and I think they were right, that the only answer in the name of free enterprise in a competitive economy is these large monsters that they really thought they were, you had to socialize them, turn them into public utilities. And I think down the line, that's probably the 20-year scenario where the big guys really cause so much trouble that none of the old solutions work, and you're left with the only answer being turn them into utilities. But again, if you think about all this, we're talking about the prehistory, as in the prehistory of the New Deal, the decades that build up slowly, steadily, like the pre-progressive era, the three decades of the end of the 19th century. Developments over time that begin to establish different institutional conditions upon which politics builds and politics aids and abets. So it's a longer-term process. Not anybody who wants an instant answer, I'd suggest, you know, bow out now, because we're talking about changing systems, and that's long-term developmental processes.
How do you anticipate? I mean, it is easier for me to envision the notion of a dozen states, maybe two dozen states, that begin to adopt some type of, let's say, just for example, Medicare, single-payer health care program. And we also know that the part of the Affordable Care Act provide seed money for cooperative nonprofit insurance companies, sort of a backdoor public option, but that is limited in some respects. And you talk about the that we have more people involved in some form of co-op across the country than actually within the context of a union. These are all institutions that are providing a service and that are parallel to existing institutions. But where does the political element come in? Because in the context of the labor movement, it was both an institution that served to provide service for its own members, but it also was an institution that translated into political influence that then perpetuated its growth. Where does that political influence, where does that awareness, that political awareness come when we around those institutions that are not really set up to translate what they're doing into political influence?
Well, it's a good question, and there's some pretty good answers. If you think about the labor movement and the union movement, just as you point out, the early years of the union movements in the United States, Samuel Gompers and the AFL-CIO were against government-provided Social Security. Now, why is that? They were against it because they thought the union should provide it for their members, and if the government did, it would take away from the union's jobs that they could say they were doing. Well, they got over that when they realized that they couldn't really do the job without government support, which meant they really had to go into politics big time, that there was a dynamic that led in that direction. And I think similarly, there's a dynamic in almost every one of these areas where you're going to be on the defensive unless you can begin to capture some of the political power that the other side's got. Another example of that is the place we know most about co-ops is in agriculture. And agricultural co-ops are all over the country now, but they built up over time and then realized they need government help. And so that's where they got most of their power, and rural electric co-ops as well. So there is a dynamic that I think leads to almost automatically to looking for help in the locality or the state and the national level. I mentioned this Cleveland, where the worker-owned companies are being supported by very large-scale worker-owned companies. One of them, for instance, is the largest urban greenhouse in America, 3 million heads of lettuce a year. That's scale production. They also have the kinds of support from the city and the state and federal government that any business can use. And it makes the mayor look good if his politics supports them. So I think you're going to see a natural evolution, both of direct services, but also as they build power, wanting more and more use of government power for the purposes that they're trying to identify. as opposed to what the corporations are trying to do.
When you survey the landscape of those people who are who share some notion that there's something systemically wrong, is there? Can you critique what you're seeing in terms of the balance between building small-scale institutions versus attempts to start political movements?
Well, you remember, I'm a historian as well as a political leader. I wear these two hats. So I'm always interested in how processes evolve. And I think right at this point in time, you're mainly seeing two tracks. There are people who are activists and who are hoping to build a movement. They actually haven't done a great deal. There have been occasional sporadic sit-ins and activist movements and a lot of talk about building a movement, which I support strongly. At the other hand, there are people who are interested in institutional development, and a lot of this is also green development and new food movement. There's a very green tint to all these changes that we're talking about, many of whom aren't yet interested in politics. Now, some parts of it are. There's a public banking movement that is really going for changing banking law. That's one, and the healthcare movement has gotten political already. But at this stage, it's very, very different parts. And the argument of the book, and indeed why write a book about this, partly to report on the things that the press doesn't report on, about all the stuff going on locally, but partly to suggest, and indeed this is why I wrote What Then Must We Do, that we are at a place where it's time to get out of the trench and look over to the next row and see that there are other people doing things that we all, if we got together and had a strategy, together we might actually begin to build power that is both political and institutional and ecologically intelligent, that is the time to be aware. And a book really is kind of like a mirror. Look into the mirror and see what's going on all around, and that might give us the idea that by moving together in a new direction, we can build power. And that's how I see it. I think it's an extraordinary period of American history, and if done intelligently and with perseverance. I mean, my heroes are the civil rights workers in Mississippi against great odds in the 1930s and 40s. Now, I admire the people in the 60s, but the people who laid the groundwork for what came later, that's really where we are now, and this is the prehistory of something potentially very important, I think. It's like the prehistory of the New Deal, the prehistory of the women's successes, the prehistory of the civil rights movement. And it involves a whole different change of institutions that is happening in many parts of the country that people just don't know about because the press doesn't report on the kind of things that I've been talking about or write about in What Then Must We Do.
So your book is filling and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but your book seems to be filling a gap that you perceive in terms of the ability of people to both adopt and create new institutions, but also to see that the people in the next county or the next state or wherever are also adopting those, so that in some way that can begin to form the synapses for a movement. What else can achieve that? One book, and it's a great book, What Then Must We Do? But one book's not going to achieve all that. I mean, what else has to happen to fill that sort of gap, to sort of develop those synapses?
Well, there are lots of things, and books are part of it. There are lots of folks involved in, you know, writing about this and talking about it. There's something called the New Economy Movement, kind of doing self-consciously, trying to promote this direction. Most important is that the pain levels are growing and people are being forced to rethink and reassess. So I see, I've been out on a lecture tour with a book, and almost everywhere I go, I find people trying to do something new and coming up to me with, they're doing something really interesting with the credit union in this area. Somebody's got a new idea of how to do a worker co-op. Things are just not covered by the press, but I'm seeing that more and more people are doing things. Another part of this has to do with Occupy. You know, the Occupy, people say, has disappeared. Well, it's disappeared from the press, that's for sure. But one of the things that happened with Occupy is that people who were isolated were pulled out of isolation and met other people and got to know them and got to realize that other people wanted to do something politically, and people didn't know that until Occupy happened. So in many parts of the country, what I discover is, you know, three or four people who met each other at Occupy and previously didn't know that there were other people like themselves are doing projects locally around the country without a whole lot of fanfare and certainly without the press paying any attention, but they're beginning to do the sort of things we're talking about here in very interesting ways. So I don't think the spirit of Occupy is over at all. I do think that the national press has turned off the floodlights, so you don't see it anymore. But the smaller scale things, I mean, how do things really start in any political movement? It's four or five people sit down and do something, like those kids who sat down at the lunch counters. And that's how things get going. And I think Occupy has played an important role in making that happen in many parts of the country, just below the floodlights.
From a historical perspective, is there a critical mass? I mean, what is that critical mass that it takes to sort of reach a level where it becomes a political movement? I mean, I think I've read that Martin Luther King was just talking about all he really needs is 5% to create change. Because, I mean, clearly, I mean, you talk about the desperation and pain that people are feeling, and particularly as we, you know, we see cutbacks, but we also see this incredible wealth inequality, and we see the breakdowns of sort of things like healthcare and whatnot. But the vast majority of people don't make that next step where they sort of relate that to what is happening in terms of a broader power dynamic. What is the critical mass you need of a population to sort of have that level of awareness and to push it forward?
You know, I don't think there's an easy answer to that, and I certainly don't know an easy answer myself. But I do know this, that the possibilities of great change occurring are historically very, very, very common. Systems change in history all the time. So let me give you some examples. And usually they're unpredicted. So let me give you a couple examples from different realms. The first one is very personal. I'm from Wisconsin, and I was brought up in Wisconsin during the Joe McCarthy era. Now, Joe McCarthy was anti-communist, but in Wisconsin, it was totally oppressive. And if you'd looked around in Wisconsin in the late 1950s and said, where McCarthy was clobbering everybody, and it was very conservative times, you gave any hope for the future? I mean, it was insane. But, of course, then the next thing that happened was the 1960s exploded. So people weren't aware that something was really going on beneath the surface. Or take another example. Apartheid collapsed, you know, in a time frame that was far, far shorter than anybody expected. The Berlin Wall and the Soviet Union collapsed. The one I like best, because it's you know, we rarely think about it in these terms, but, you know, a bunch of farmers and small merchants and businessmen in a tiny little fragment of poor, poor settlements along the Atlantic seaboard took on the British Empire, the most powerful empire in the world, and they won the American Revolution. So big change is far more common, and usually it starts, you don't see it coming, but there's something bubbling up that then flips when something ignites it. I'm not predicting that's inevitable, but I'm also saying people who dismiss that possibility ignore history as conventional patterns in history, often as pain increases, begin to explode in different ways than is normally thought. Like in the book, I recall a historian who says, we tend to remember the future. Now, what does that mean? Well, we think about the future as only from the ideas we have from the past. It's been like this all the time. It's bound to be, you know, if it's bad now, it's just going to continue bad. We remember and then project. Well, that's not always useful. Things do change. The women's movement exploded. The civil rights movement exploded. The early environmental movement exploded. The conservatives were in minuscule power in 1945 and 48, and they developed a political movement of great power. So if you look at things historically, the one thing that's obvious is that possibilities beyond the moment are always there. They're not inevitable, and it is certainly possible. And in the last chapter of the book, I say, you know, it's possible that, like Rome, America will simply decay. But it's also, and it could go to a very violent stage and maybe even a corporate state of repression. But on the other hand, if you look to Latin America, where all the repressive systems, those dictators, you know, people move beyond that as well. And it is also possible that we are laying the foundations for something very, very interesting that is progressive and democratizes ownership and is very American in nature. And that's the place to put your energy rather than, you know, a lot of folks who will say, well, nothing can be done. Pessimism has its own rewards. You don't have to do anything. So I always ask my pessimistic friends to ask seriously, have they allowed themselves to think of what they might do? And then all of a sudden you got to do something if you think something's possible. But if you think nothing can happen, you just get to loaf.
Carl Alperovitz, the book is What Then Must We Do? We'll put a link to the book and to your site at majority.fm. Can't thank you enough for taking the time today.
No, thanks for having me, Sam. Appreciate it.
All right, folks. We have once again given you far. Well, I don't know what it is about talking to the socialists, but we end up giving out so much more free content when we do that. All right, we're going to head into the better half of the program. Folks, this, I don't know. I guess the Majority Report, the Majority Report, I think, is, this is a capitalist enterprise. However, with that said, it is socialistic in the sense that our members basically support the non-members in this situation and allow for the show to exist for everyone for free. So if you have the ability to be one of those people who want to give back to the fellow listeners and keep this show going, you can become a member today at majority.fm. And if you are full-on consumerist and buy your junk through Amazon, do so through our link. At least we get a kickback. You won't know the difference. You can find the link on the homepage of majority.fm. Just click on it, bookmark it. That becomes your Amazon. Buy your crap through there. And like I say, we get a kickback. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Get a 10% discount using the coupon code MAJORITY. That's one of the co-ops that Gar Alvovitz was talking about. Support it. On the program tomorrow, Cliff Schechter, Isabel Gillies. Yes, it's Friday already, Matt. Can you believe how quickly the week is gone? I know you're shocked. The number is 646-257-3920. Coming up in the better half. I didn't realize this guy was still on, but I guess he's on Fox News, right? What was that dude's name again?
Lou Dobbs.
Lou Dobbs.
I think it's Fox Business.
Fox Business, whatever Dobbs. It is. Lou Dobbs. Talking about, and Eric Erickson talking about this apocalypse that is taking place, apparently, in America because women are the chief breadwinners in many homes.
It's sort of like a horrifying version of the cast of Anchorman.
Yeah, there you go. All right. Also, we'll talk about James Comey. And a really interesting piece. I didn't even save this one. But about labor union decline. Union decline and how it matches up with labor's continuing decline in the share of the income in this country. And also a new study that apparently is coming out soon by Darren Acemoglu. We had him on some time ago, which talks about the failure of the sort of technocratic model the one that doesn't really contemplate politics. And also, we'll get to this Thomas Friedman story just because it's Thomas Friedman. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a minute. 646-257-3920. We'll be right back after this.
Why can't she ever see?